Today is Friday, February 18th, 2022. This is part one of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Gary Ladd. Last name spelled L-A-D-D. My name is Tom Martin, and we are at our home here in Flagstaff, Arizona on this lovely sunny day. And Gary, thank you so much for your willingness to sit down and do a little oral history work. Gary, what year were you born?
1947.
Where?
Cleveland Heights, Ohio.
Cleveland Heights. What were your folks doing there?
My mother was a homemaker, and my father had gone back to work for F.W. Woolworth. He spent his entire life, except for his years in the service, working for Woolworths.
Okay. And did he serve in World War II?
He did. In fact, both my parents did, yeah.
What did your mom do in World War II?
She was a WAC, Women's Air Corps. They met in India and were married there. Well, I'm sorry to say I don't know as nearly as much as I'd like to. I think I'd have to ask my sister. She probably remembers more. But the story was of my father and a buddy of his saw some WACs get off of a bus, and my father said, "I'm going to marry that woman," which he did.
Wow.
And my father grew up in Ohio, and my mother was in northern West Virginia, so they grew up not too far from one another and were married after the atomic bombs were dropped, but they were still in India at the time. So the war had just ended. And came home. My mother's family was appalled by what had happened, marrying some guy from northern Ohio that she met on the far side of the world. But it seems to have worked out. And my father was from, they lived in several places in northern Ohio, and he went back to work for Woolworths. And actually, I can never remember whether I was born in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, or Shaker Heights, Ohio. I think we were living in Cleveland Heights, and next door is Shaker Heights. My father, I think by then, was already a store manager, or if he wasn't, he was about to become one. So we moved from Cleveland Heights or Shaker Heights to Lorain, only 6 months after I was born, and lived there for 2 years. And then,
Gary, I'm going to ask a question here. Your mother was in the Women's Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
What was your father doing in the service?
He was being utilized for his knowledge about stocking stores, so he ran a PX.
Okay.
And my mother was a secretary.
Okay, so she wasn't flying. She wasn't in air transport.
No.
Okay. Nice. Well, that's okay. So your dad was, if he was in procurement and supplies, he was working for Woolworth before the war.
Yes, long before the war.
Okay. So he, for Woolworth, was he in stocking, purchasing sort of thing then?
He started out, he grew up extremely poor. Various disasters befell his family. And there were times when they were literally down to their last nickel and dimes. And he talks about going to the playground and going to the swings and kicking the dirt under the swings, just looking for change that had fallen out from pockets. So as he left his family early because his mother had remarried after some of these disasters, and because he had been kind of the head of the family from the time he was, I don't know, 12 or 14. And then along comes another husband, so he left. And he decided he was going to get a job that paid and decided that Woolworths was the way to do it. So he couldn't get a job at first, but he found somebody working for Woolworths who allowed him to work for free in the stockroom.
Wow.
And he made himself indispensable, which led to his being hired.
Nice.
So I don't know when he became manager. I don't know anything about the sequence of different jobs he would have had, but by the time I showed up, he was assistant manager or manager of stores. Yeah.
Had he graduated from high school?
He did not. He did not quite graduate from high school.
Yeah. Okay. And how old was he when he went into service?
He was drafted right after Pearl Harbor, so he was born in 1914, and Pearl Harbor, by the time he was drafted, it would have been 42, so 28.
Okay. And if he was in India, were they part of servicing the Burma, the Burma hump flying into China?
You know, I don't know much about that, but he often mentioned a CBI.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so then after the war, back to Woolworths, sort of business as usual then for them, and time to raise a family? And
yeah, I think so.
Okay, or did that travel overseas change them in any way that you might be aware of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I don't have any comments about that because I just don't know what they were like before.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I interfered.
Born in Ohio in 1947, did you have any older sisters or brothers?
I was the first. So, okay. After we lived in Lorain for 2 years, we moved to Detroit, Michigan. And I'm sure that my father was a manager at the time. And a brother and a sister showed up a few years after my birth. So they were born in 53 and 54.
Okay. So did you, in Michigan, you would have been 4 or 5 when you guys moved there?
3, I believe, 3. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then you went to grade school in Michigan, in Detroit?
Yes, I did, yes.
What do you remember about that?
I don't remember very much. We lived on a street by the name of Runyon, 14500 Runyon. And I walked to school, and it was through an area with very modest homes, and crossed a major street, and then we had to pass what was known as the projects, which was never presented to me as an undesirable area, but it was low-income housing. Hmm. And right now I don't remember the name of the school, maybe Hoover. And we moved from there when I was 9. And I really don't remember a whole lot about living in Detroit, other than we used to climb a lot of trees. I had a girlfriend who lived down Runyon, whose name was Rosemary. I wonder what happened to her.
Mm.
And anytime we ever had company, we would take them to the Ford plant or the General Motors plants to watch cars being assembled.
Oh, wow.
That was kind of the big thing to do. And, of course, this was the heyday of Detroit right after World War II.
What do you remember of those journeys? What did you see? I mean, just like car assembly, the whole chassis being laid down on conveyor belts? Were they, like, giving you a tour? You walked right through the plant?
Yeah, there was a tour leader. And, you know, I don't remember any particular scene of just cars being put together. Except that the floor that we walked on was kind of like a really hard blacktop, and apparently there were heavy vehicles that ran back and forth on that floor at times, and nuts and bolts have been embedded in that blacktop or whatever it was, which I really wanted to extract. I could not. I guess that's my main memory, is being frustrated by unable to pick those up.
During this time, when you were growing up in, let's see, you moved to Michigan in 56. To Detroit, is that right?
1950. We moved to Michigan and stayed there until 56.
And then where did you go from 56?
In 56, we moved back to northern Ohio.
Okay.
To Rocky River, Ohio. And we lived there for 7 years. And I got involved with the Cleveland Indians, and I was a big Indians fan, and went to Kensington Grade School in Rocky River, and then to Rocky River Junior High School, and then to 2 years of Rocky River High School.
Okay. During that time, did your family go on vacations at all?
We did, and usually it was with my mother's relatives from West Virginia. And they would drive up from West Virginia, and either we would go into northern Michigan.
Like the Boundary Waters kind of?
Not that far.
Okay.
Mostly not that far.
That's not... Okay.
We went to Houghton Lake, Michigan, which is an artificial lake.
Okay.
Kind of right in the middle of the hand of Michigan. And in that particular year, we vacationed with a lot of Woolworth people.
And, okay.
Spent a whole week there, boating on the lake and going canoeing and other stuff. But usually we were vacationing in Oscoda, Michigan, which was on Lake Huron.
Okay.
Or we would make trips up into Canada to go on fishing trips to North Bay, Ontario. And also we made a lot of trips or passed through Niagara Falls on a lot of those trips.
Okay.
I'd like to see Niagara Falls today because most of the times I saw it, I was really young. So those memories have kind of faded.
So in high school, your first 2 years of high school, had you gotten into photography by then?
Okay, for some reason, I can remember standing in line at a grocery store with my parents, and I think there was a display there of some cheap camera, and I asked if I could have a camera. And I remember the answer, which was, when you get to be 8, you can have a camera. So I don't know when that happened, but before I was 8, anyway.
Wow.
So Detroit or Rocky River.
What would have been attracting you to that? Before 8, did you have an understanding that this gizmo takes images?
I would guess, but I don't know where that request came from. And
okay.
I don't understand even why I would remember that. In fact, I'm suspicious that I remember it because I feel like it's embedded in my brain so deeply, I don't know anything about where it comes from.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure it happened.
And when you were 8, did you get a camera?
Not that I know of, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
My first connection with a camera was I actually was allowed to use my father's camera, which was a twin lens reflex. So it used 120 or 220 film, which I struggled with. It seemed like it was always wrinkling in the camera. I don't think that was a very expensive camera, but It was kind of common at that time, a twin lens reflex. But somewhere shortly after using that camera, or perhaps earlier than using that camera, I did have a really inexpensive 120 or 220 film camera. And it was just plastic. It, of course, had no light meter. There was nothing to it. But I was using that pretty early. And I used cameras like that, either an inexpensive 120 camera or maybe my father's camera, up until the time I got into high school. And this would have taken place after we had moved again. So I'm going to jump one more city.
Okay.
In 1956, we moved to Rocky River, and in 63 moved from Rocky River to the outskirts of St. Louis, Missouri, Chesterfield, Missouri. And that was a huge, important event in my life. I had a rough time in Rocky River. I was not well thought of. I was not getting good grades. My parents were concerned about me. Even though I didn't realize it, it was best to get out of that place. And in St. Louis, it all changed dramatically. I was an okay guy. And I'm not sure what happened, but the atmosphere at that high school was much different.
Hmm.
The Rocky River High School was very stratified. There were people that were right on top and people in the middle, and I was in the bottom layer. So in St. Louis, it was a new school system. It had been farmland up until just before we arrived, and the schools were brand new and growing at...
Wow.
20% a year, I believe. I think the year before I arrived, there were 800 kids in school, and there were 1,000 in my next year, and there were 1,200 the year after that.
Wow.
And it was fantastic. And I got involved with, for the first time, singing in a choir, a high school choir. Because we had a neighbor where we lived who was really deeply involved in music, and she was a member of that choir, and told me I needed to become active in it. So I tried out for it, and I, even though I had no experience, and I'm not sure if they let just anyone in or not, but I did get into that choir, and that led to a number of things that eventually led to the Grand Canyon. The instructor was Jerry Galloway. Jerry was a woman, and she was unmarried, and she had a roommate who was a biology teacher at that school who was interested in cameras. And so I got to know that second teacher also. Melba James was her name. And through her, through her help, helping my parents, they selected a real 35 millimeter camera, a Konica camera, for the first time.
I'm going to go back a little bit here before the 35 millimeter showed up. Were you doing your own developing, or no? You were sending your film out?
Yes.
And it would come back. Mm-hmm. Were you, I mean, because taking pictures back then required, like you say, you didn't have a light meter. You'd figure out the light, trying to figure out the speed. And those little plastic cameras, could you adjust any of that, or was it just a click?
Yeah. The plastic cameras that I was using, the roll of film came with some instructions. If you're taking pictures out in bright sunlight or in shade or indoors or at night, that first plastic camera, and I have no idea who made it, there were no controls. And so it was made for using out in the direct sun.
Hmm.
And a lot of times I was using black and white film, which would be a little more forgiving on messing up the exposure. On my father's cameras, there would have been controls. So okay. I would be following the instructions that came with the film. But it wasn't until I got the Konica that there was an actual light meter. And the light meter, of course, did not look through the lens. It was just an eye that sat out on the front of the camera and measured everything that was in every direction in front of the camera. But that was a huge improvement, though.
And so what year is this? This is, you're still in high school? This is
63 to 65, yeah.
Okay. That camera had a light meter. So you would have to look at the light meter and then adjust the
right.
f-stop and the, or the speed,
right,
depending on what the light meter said. This
right.
wasn't one you held in your hand. It was
no.
in the gizmo, but it wouldn't set anything for you.
That's right. It may have had the option of setting the exposure.
Okay.
But I'm not sure how much I used that, because as soon as I got that camera, I was totally fascinated by it. And I remember just swallowing the instruction manual, reading it over and over again, because it was really, really interesting. So I don't know how many exposures I was making just using the automatic mode, but I think that camera had what would it now be called, or was then called, a match needle. You'd look through the viewfinder and you would see a needle scan from top to bottom, and then you would set the exposure according to where that needle was on a scale.
Okay. So if the needle was low, you would do something, and if the needle
right.
was high, you'd do something else.
Right, yeah.
Okay. And that would be just how much light the meter was seeing in front of it.
That's
in front
right.
of the can.
Yeah.
Okay. And you still weren't developing your own images then?
I have never done that.
Okay.
Except when I worked at Kitt Peak.
Okay. All right. So I just want to, just trying to put that in perspective. In high school in St. Louis, was there a camera class, or was it just Melba James that was encouraging you on there?
No camera club or class that I can remember. I don't think so. But Melba James helped and was essential in picking out what camera that I had asked for, a 35 millimeter camera. But I don't remember her even helping me learn that camera. It came from the instruction manual.
Okay. And that would have been fairly expensive, I'm assuming.
I think around $100 at that time.
Which in 1964 is fairly expensive.
And $400 or $500, the equivalent.
Yeah, yeah. So that was an investment that your parents
yeah.
were willing to make in you.
Yeah.
Based on what they had seen you doing with the plastic camera. Okay, that's pretty neat.
The $5 camera.
During 63, 65, were you guys still going up to Northern Michigan vacation time?
No.
Okay.
Once we moved to St. Louis, we started exploring the West a little more. So we made a long trip to Grand Canyon and Petrified Forest and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Salt Lake City. That would have been the summer of 64.
And that was your first time west?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Station wagon? Car?
Yep.
Station wagon?
Station wagon.
Okay. You and your younger sister and younger brother and
yep.
mom and dad. So
all in that
five
station
of
wagon.
You piled in there with all kinds of camping gear and camera and
yep, arguing fairly often.
And you drove from St. Louis all the way to the West Coast.
Yeah, 2 weeks we made the tour.
Were you old enough to drive then? Did you help in the
No.
driving or just your mom and dad?
Yeah, just my dad, really, I
Oh,
think.
wow. Okay. Where did you go? Run that past me again?
I'm sure I don't remember every place, but the places that really stick out in my mind, I'm pretty sure we went to Petrified Forest. I know absolutely for sure that we visited Grand Canyon. I can remember camping out on the alongside the road west of Cameron. We went in to the park that way,
Okay.
and we hiked down the Bright Angel Trail a very short distance, maybe only as far as the first tunnel. And on the way out, my mother got a nosebleed. She hadn't done anything like that in decades.
Well, it was altitude as well. You guys
Yeah.
had come from St. Louis, and it was very dry, so
Yeah.
it would have been a totally different climate.
Right. So we didn't go far, but I'll tell you, the place impressed me, and we may have camped at a campground that I think predated Mather Campground.
Okay.
Was there such a place? It would,
I would have to look. I don't, I'm not sure.
yeah.
Yeah.
So, from there we, oh, well, we had never seen the desert before, so this was really something. And I remember getting to Boulder City and being shocked by the green grass there after having seen all of these desert areas prior to that. So I think that means we visited Hoover Dam, then Los Angeles, and we went to, going to say we went to Disneyland on that trip, but I'm not sure about that. And then to San Francisco, and we had relatives in Sacramento. And went to Lake Tahoe and then to Salt Lake City and then back to St. Louis.
Wow.
So I said we explored the West after we got to St. Louis, but the following year we went back east. We went to New York City. And we may have driven on that trip. And my father at that time had moved up. He was pretty high on the ladder with the Woolworth organization, and he was making trips from St. Louis to New York City fairly often for meetings. So he wanted to show us Sardi's and the Woolworth Building, which had at one time been the tallest building in the world. I think it was built in about 1928, and it's still a beautiful building today.
And of course, the Empire State Building.
Yes, and I don't actually remember our visit, but I still have a souvenir publication from there. So
And
I
Statue
get
of Liberty, did you go out there?
Okay, I don't remember going out there on that trip,
Okay.
but I had been there as a little kid with my parents, and I think it was before my brother and sister were born. And at that time, you could go up into the arm of the Statue of Liberty,
Up to the flame, to the
yeah,
torch.
to the torch. And I may be confusing things here, but I think from the crown of the Statue of Liberty, there weren't any windows in there. You were just looking out an opening. And they gave me a look out that window, and I had a hat on, which I took off and threw out, which they never found. So I don't remember that. I must have been really young.
On your trips, on that first trip in '64 to the West, and then next year to New York, were you always with your camera?
I had a camera then because I've got pictures from Las Vegas taken at night, and Of course, I didn't know what I was doing and had never attempted anything like that, and they really turned out surprisingly well. So, yes, I had a camera on those trips. Yeah.
Were you more interested in landscapes or in close-ups or in everything?
I think it was more or less everything. Because I was doing landscapes, but I was doing a lot of family pictures, pictures of where we lived, pictures of all types. So I don't remember landscapes being very important at that time. They were just part of a big group.
Okay. And then would you, did you have a hesitancy to come up and take a picture of somebody's full face with your camera, or did you get over that?
Well, I don't feel like I've ever taken very many kind of portrait-like pictures. I've never had very much interest in it. And at least later on, by later on, I never felt like that was quite right. And part of that comes from in later photography life, I have really gotten tired of people going on vacations to exotic, distant lands where the population wears different clothing and has different habits, and then bringing those photographs to a photo show to be judged. I just don't understand how they fit in pictures of people in strange dresses or costumes. I don't know why people would bring those to be judged when everybody else in the room has got landscape photographs. And yeah,
Interesting. Okay.
so I now am very sorry that I did not take a whole lot more pictures of people who were on trips that I was on. Both friends and, I did decades worth of elder hostel trips and photo workshops. I wish I had a photograph of every one of those groups, and I have almost nothing. That's,
Hindsight,
yeah,
it's
well.
just what it is. Well, now that's interesting that as in high school, you were looking at objects, okay, group of people, landscapes, but not so much that full frame person's head, hands, feet, that sort of journey.
Did not interest me.
Okay. Then in high school, junior and senior, St. Louis, your last 2 years in high school, did you start developing a sense of, I want to be a fill in the blank?
I don't think so. What was happening, I'm quite sure, was having moved from Rocky River to St. Louis, suddenly the outdoors became much more important. At Rocky River, there was a city park that was undeveloped. It was a couple of baseball fields, but then a lot of just forest, really just let go, not trimmed or taken care of, and a little stream running through that forest. And other kids would go to that park either to play baseball or to play in that stream, making dams and rechanneling it and stuff like that. Other than that, I don't remember being too involved in the outdoors unless we were on vacation at Lake Huron. But in St. Louis, it changed because all of a sudden we were living out in farmland, even though all these subdivisions were being carved out of that farmland. And there were some interesting state parks not too far away, and really nice canoeing streams. And I and some other high school kids did some canoe trips. I don't remember the names of all of those streams, but the Current River was one of them.
Did you have a canoe? Did your family have a canoe, or did you borrow from friends?
I'm not sure how it started, but we ended up with a canoe, which my sister used one time, and she and her boyfriend wrecked it, bent it, and doubled it. So it didn't last very long, and it was an aluminum canoe. It was a Grumman. It was a good canoe, yes. But that was okay. That wasn't a disaster because I was about to go to college anyway. So,
was it assumed in your household that you and your siblings were going to go to college?
Yes. Because neither of my parents did go to college, and they insisted on it. I would have been more interested in, and this is what I told my dad, and he found this completely unacceptable. I wanted to work in a gasoline station and learn how engines were operated, and maybe not become a mechanic, but at least learn more about engines and cars.
Okay, well, that was a time when cars represented freedom. And when did you get your driver's license?
Yeah. Oh, well, I got it in Rocky River as soon as I turned 16. But
okay.
I didn't have a car of my own until I was out of college.
Ah. Okay. Okay, driver's license at 16. 1965, graduated from high school. I'm working out the math here. You are 18?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The Vietnam War is going great guns.
Yeah.
And there was a draft. How did that work out? What were your parents thinking about that? They had served.
I wonder about that myself. I don't remember any discussion about being drafted. They were going to make sure that I went to college.
Okay.
I wouldn't have to worry about being drafted until I got out of college. So I just don't remember any discussion or anything having to do with the draft.
Okay. And it wasn't like you're like, okay, as soon as I'm out of high school, I'm going to join the Army or I'm going to join the Air Force because my folks and I'm going to go serve.
That's the part that I wish I knew more about, because I feel like today, looking back on it, as if they in that way were not very patriotic. I never heard them say, boy, going to the service would be good for you, or this is your duty. I never heard them say that.
Do you think it was possible that they wanted to head you off to college based on what they saw in World War II, their experiences in the service?
Maybe. I don't know. And I'm not saying that they weren't patriotic people,
because
I think they were, but
sure.
There was just no indication that the military should be part of my life from them.
Okay. And then college, for somebody who's a photographer, sings in the choir, were you in any other sporting or any other clubs and stuff in high school?
I tried to play baseball, which I had a strong interest in that part of my life, but got injured immediately, and that was the end of my baseball career very quickly.
Okay.
So I wasn't in any other clubs, but the choir became very important because there was another guy in that choir. I can't recall his name right now, but he was the student manager, and we became good friends. And being a student manager of the choir mostly meant that we had two or three concerts during the year. And there was no place to perform in the school except for the gym. So we had to convert the gym into a concert hall. And I don't think this would be allowed today. Almost got his name there. Mm. But his father was an engineer, electrical engineer. Joel, the son, had a background in wiring. Joel somehow gathered up a bunch of junk, rheostats and wiring and lights, and we transformed part of the gym into a concert hall, and it was
wow.
It was done not very sophisticated, but with big curtains that came down from a very high ceiling in that gym. And this control panel that he wired and put together, and all sorts of plugs and cables going up to lights. And then there was a stage, risers essentially. But we would build sets, pretty simple sets, on those risers for some parts of the concert.
Wow.
And we had somebody who controlled the lights. And there were no other lights in the room that were suitable for that kind of activity. It was all what Joel had put together.
Wow.
So Joel and I were allowed to use scaffolding and climb up the scaffolding and mount the lights and run the wires. And there was no other supervising people except for Miss Galloway, and she let Joel do what he wanted. And
nice.
And then
how
I
empowering.
Built.
How empowering.
I'm sorry?
How empowering.
Yeah. You know, I just feel like today you probably would never be allowed to do that because it was dangerous to do this and dangerous to do that. And you can't have students.
Electricity and rheostats and lights heavy up in the air. And
but we were allowed to do all of that. It was just a riot. It was wonderful.
And nice.
But that was the beginning of what, as I said before, led me to Grand Canyon, because Kay Wonder, that neighbor of mine who got me interested in the choir, connected me with Miss Galloway, the choir director. And Miss Galloway had gone to Central Methodist College, which was in the middle of the state, halfway between St. Louis and Kansas City, and not very far away from Columbia and the University of Missouri and Stevens College. And my grades still weren't very good, and I was able to get into that college.
To Central Methodist.
Central Methodist College, which is now called Central Methodist University. And there, I feel like my life really began. I got involved in the choir there, and the first year I was in what was called the chapel choir, and we had to go to chapel once a week, the entire student body, and we sang at those weekly gatherings in a church. But everybody really wanted to get into the a cappella choir, which I did my second year.
Oh, wow.
And that choir rehearsed 4 days a week.
Wow.
In preparation for a tour in the spring. And we would either tour Eastern Missouri or Western Missouri, switching back and forth on consecutive years.
How many people in the a cappella group?
About 35 or 40.
So there was a big group of people.
Yeah.
Cranking it out. Wow.
Yeah, and you had to be very devoted to it. You could not be late to practice. And it was rare for anyone to miss any practices.
And at that time, this is your freshman and sophomore years, were you just taking general study courses, or did you have a degree in mind then?
I don't think I had a degree in mind, but I was interested in the sciences, so the first one I took was geology.
Oh, wow.
And they only offered 2 semesters of geology. And then I took astronomy the second year. I might have those reversed, but I think that was the sequence.
Okay.
And I eventually was allowed a degree called a divisional science degree, which was geology and biology more than anything else, comparative anatomy, astronomy.
Nice. I mean, sounds like it's a sort of a general science degree.
Right, yeah.
Not a specific geology or astronomy or biology.
Correct, yeah.
That's very nice. So you're in the a cappella group, and you had mentioned that Kay Wunder, or Mrs. Galloway, had mentioned the Central Methodist. And did you have to work there to make your tuition, or did your folks help you with the tuition there?
They more or less paid the tuition, but I did work. I started working at the student radio station. So the radio station was completely run by students. There was hardly any supervision by the adults. And I think we did a terrific job. And at first I was just a newscaster. There were several newscasts during the day, and various students would come in and give the 9:30 newscast and the noon newscast and so forth. But there was a big newscast, I think, at 5 o'clock that required just about all of us to help with it. And we also covered the elections when there were big national elections really well, just by listening to the radio, putting together a broadcast that lasted several hours.
How did you get the news? You mentioned, were you listening to, were you watching TV, trying to gather stuff? Did you have a teletype? Were you getting AP bulletins coming in, or?
No teletype. You know, news usually was just local news, campus news, with the exception of those national elections.
Okay. So just stuff that was happening on campus.
Right.
Then you'd have to go out and scrape that news up, right? I mean, people would have to gumshoe, do some reporting.
Yes, although we also relied on this, on the newspaper for stories or story ideas.
Okay.
But a lot of times there were press releases or story releases by organizations who wanted this to become known on campus.
Got it. Okay.
But then the last couple of years, I think, that I was there, I was the business manager of the radio station.
Wow.
I think I was still doing newscasts, but there wasn't a whole lot to that job because I don't remember how much the station manager was paid, but the other 3 or 4 of us on the staff, I think, used to remember what this was. I think we were only paid $17 a month for our work. So, but I also worked in the cafeteria at times, just dishing out food. And I don't think I did that a whole lot, but I did it some.
Okay. Was this a quarter system, or was it a spring and a fall semester system?
2 semesters, yeah.
And so in the summer, what would you do?
I haven't the vaguest idea.
Did you go back west, or did you stay?
Well, I'm kind of joking. After my freshman year, Yeah. After my freshman year, my parents moved again back to Northern Ohio.
Okay.
And we ended up living in Medina. So all of these towns I've mentioned are all in the Cleveland area. And we got into a big fiasco, family fiasco, because we really wanted to live in Rocky River, Ohio again. And couldn't find a house, but we found a lot that was for sale. And it was a great lot that backed up on a forested area that dropped down to Rocky River itself, the river, which is really a stream. But it's a park area. And this lot was actually part of a larger lot that the owners wanted to subdivide. And it was on a cul-de-sac and kind of in a somewhat exclusive area. And the neighbors went crazy and started fighting it. And it got too messy. And we eventually had to find a house, and that was in Medina. But it meant that part of that summer, we lived in an apartment complex, and we had taken over two apartments, and both of them were full of our junk from the houses. And it's kind of a miserable existence.
Wow.
And then had to move all that stuff again. So that took care of one summer. And I don't remember a whole lot about the other summer, because we moved right back to St. Louis again by the time I was in my senior year. And okay, I do remember going back to St. Louis. My first summer in St. Louis, I went to summer school there. And it was in a school without any air conditioning.
Ooh.
And I don't think classes ran into the summer, but it got hot enough by noon. I do remember that quite well. Not sure why I had to do that, but maybe it was just to keep me busy in a new place.
Okay. This was in the 60s. It was a turbulent time in the country, and it was a time of rock and roll and drugs and long hair and hippies. It was a big generational shift from your parents' generation to your generation and your grandparents' generation to your generation. Did you embrace that culture? Did you have long hair? Did you have a beard? Or were you more in the middle of the road kind of thing?
I think my parents, and therefore I, were very conservative. I don't think I knew much about anything that you just mentioned.
Okay.
We were not part of it.
All right.
About all I can remember is I really did like the Beatles, and I still do. But the rest of it, the long hair, no. The beard, no. Drugs, no. Nope, that was in a different world.
Well, you were going to a Methodist college.
Yeah.
So, and chapel once a week.
Yep.
So that was a kind of different type of road.
Isolated. Okay, so.
And were you taking pictures then during your college years?
I was, yeah. And I'm going to glue on a couple more steps here.
Please.
So I was in the choir. I also got involved in a professional fraternity having to do with music.
Hmm.
So choir and band in that school were both very important. And there was a Phi Mu Alpha fraternity. Not a social fraternity, but a professional fraternity that was active there. And I pledged to that fraternity and was involved in it for the rest of my college career.
Hmm.
Mostly, the most important thing that group did was put on a spring presentation of music. And we prepared much of the year for that. And that, I don't fully appreciate even now what we did. Some of it, I'm sure, was illegal, because we would pick out show songs, largely. And these were copyrighted, which we never bothered to mess with. But we had people that were so talented that they could listen to the music and write out all of the parts for all of the instruments. And
wow.
Staggering to me. So we never even paid for the sheet music.
Oh, you made your own.
Yeah.
Wow. Were you playing an instrument then?
No. I was just in the choir.
Singing.
And involved in this fraternity.
And the a cappella group, did you keep that going?
Yeah, for my entire career. And I became the manager of that, student manager of that.
Okay. Wow, you were busy.
Well, I haven't even gotten to where I really spent my time.
Which is?
The time consumer was the radio station, but then here's where I'm going to glue on some more. In my geology class, so I think this is proof that geology was the first of the sciences I took. In the second semester, one of the, I think he was a lab teacher. He was a student, but he took care of the labs, the laboratories that we did. He was involved in caving in Missouri. And Missouri has more caves than any other state. Jim Huckins was his name. Huckins, to me, was H-U-C-K-I-N-S. Huckins, to me, was just an incredible guy. He was really interesting. He was really smart. He was doing these cave things. He was interested in geology. And I saw a presentation that he made to class about his cave explorations, and got in touch with him, and pretty soon I was involved in caves, and this just opened up a whole new world. And this is where photography suddenly becomes an important part of my life.
You know what, Gary, this sounds like we're going to open up a big deal. Because not only am I going to want to know about all the gear you guys were using in 1964, 65 when you were caving, but then how that photography got in there as well. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series and wrap up part one. And part two, you will pick up here with Jim Huckins and your first journey underground. What do you think?
Well, you have a better feel for how much time this whole thing's going to take.
We've been going an hour now, and I'm like, oh, I got a bunch of questions, and I want to hear about this because I think this is important.
Really? We've been going for an hour? Is that right?
Time goes by just like that. Yeah. So what I'd like to do is let's go into Jim and the caving. But I want to finish part one by seeing if there are any other loose ends in this first part that you can think, oh, I also wanted to mention blah. Because I think we got a good idea where to go forward. Is there anything else looking back that we didn't catch?
I don't think so. Because to me, the way my life has gone was connected to Central Methodist College and geology and the choir and the radio station and Jim Huckins. And that leads directly to everything else.
Excellent. Great. Okay, well, with that, this will conclude part one of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Charles Gary Ladd. Today is Friday, February 18th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Gary, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.